The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Well, first, now that bird watching's on the table, what is the name for the most socialist bird known to man? The common tern. On to business. In the last 6 months, we've seen some seriously important developments in the union movement in the United States. Are there any teachers from West Virginia or Arizona here? The teachers of West Virginia, 55 counties strong, kicked off an actual strike wave, the first of its kind in the United States in decades, led first and foremost by pockets of militant rank and file teachers who led a fight that pushed past anti-union laws and the conservatism of their own union leaderships to directly confront their state's government's latest criminal devaluation of teacher and student lives. And then just last Wednesday, on the other side of the fence, the Supreme Court dealt the single largest legal blow to unions since the Taft-Hartley Act of 1947 with the Janus versus AFSCME decision, which outlaws required contributions from workers and unionized workplaces in the public sector. Without an ongoing rank-and-file upsurge in the public sector, this decision will fundamentally and critically weaken unions' institutional ability to protect workers' wages and working conditions. It will also weaken public sector unions' ability to fight against the ongoing dismantling of public services, whether that be in education, healthcare, or the myriad of other necessary social services. And it is incredibly important that going into this horrific situation, that we have the example of West Virginia and Oklahoma and Arizona that shows how you can navigate this terrain of right to work and of wholesale destruction of union rights and union strength. So it is also, I think, then very good timing. And it's a very good time for socialists and other union and left activists to take a step back and take a deeper look at some of the structures and dynamics of unions under capitalism. My hope in this talk is that I can articulate some theoretical guideposts for how we in the ISO, other socialists and radical left activists, and fellow union militants can navigate important questions about how to best rebuild and extend working class power in the country and around the world. Unions are the main organizational outcomes of working people's perpetual struggle to have some control over some of the most important aspects of our lives, namely our economic well-being and how we are treated at work, the place where we spend a significant amount of our waking lives. The fight for unions can involve both economic and political demands, meaning the fight for immediate economic improvement from employers, and if we're lucky, making demands from the state to increase the rights on the job, use union power to tackle particular attacks against sections of workers, and to create better conditions in our communities. Unions under capitalism, though, are a self-limited project, meaning that they exist because socialism does not, and that they are ultimately necessary because of the exploitative and oppressive working conditions that are necessary for capitalism to exist. When those conditions cease to exist, so will the need for unions. Therefore, unions as an institution do not have an inherent interest in uprooting the social relations of capital. In fact, their existence depends on them. In other words, unions exist to negotiate the conditions of exploitation and oppression, not in order to end their root causes. They are organizations designed and developed to reform present conditions. It takes conscious socialist political organization to overcome the limitations inherent in trade union organization, to ultimately push beyond the seesaw of organizing and winning better conditions, only to have them taken away and conceded years later. Using strikes and other forms of mass collective working class organization to cripple capital and the state are the only way that working people ultimately can shift the balance of power permanently in our favor. Even smaller battles, both inside and outside the workplace, can help advance mightily class consciousness and create conditions for the development of revolutionary socialist consciousness and organization. Recognizing this broader context does not mean that socialists should be dismissive of unions in any way. In fact, we know that unions are some of the most important schools of struggle, organization, and power for working people. Union struggles can bring several things to light for us and our coworkers, namely the true colors of our bosses and our governments. It forces us to think about what ideas we need and what ideas we have to combat to truly bind ourselves together as working people in order to be stronger and more successful. Unions have been developing under capitalism since its birth, and now exist in most countries and have for some time. Most unions, especially in the more developed capitalist countries, have developed elaborate structures with full-time officials, elected leaders, paid staff members, political departments, etc., etc. Over time, because of these structures and their degree of removal from rank and file life, and because of pressures from capital, these structures within unions become ossified and bureaucratized, meaning they develop and take on interests and a life of their own, apart from the objective interests of the rank and file. How socialists understand this bureaucracy factors heavily in how we develop strategies within union work. To quote Tony Cliff and Donnie Gluckstein in chapter 2 of their book about the general strike in the United Kingdom in 1926, they say, "The trade union bureaucracy is a distinct, basically conservative social formation. Like the god Janus, it presents two faces. It balances between the employers and the workers. It holds back and controls workers' struggle, but it has a vital interest not to push the collaboration with employers and the state to a point where it makes unions completely impotent. For the official is not an independent arbitrator. If the union fails entirely to articulate members' grievances, this will lead eventually either to effective internal challenges to the leadership or to membership apathy and organizational disintegration, with members moving to a rival union. If the union bureaucracy strays too far into the bourgeois camp, it will lose its base. The bureaucracy has an interest in preserving union organization, which is the source of their income and their social status." So we have in this passage a number of different important ideas. For starters, I think it speaks to the fact that nothing is static under capitalism because of its profound contradictions. Everything is in constant motion. The voracious needs of capital to constantly increase profits and economic growth clash with the constant struggles and degrees of organization of working people who are trying to fight against this organized theft. The goal of unions, from the standpoint of the bureaucracy, is existence. So they are compelled to try and balance this contradiction. Sometimes this means waging a fight, which involves agitation, increasing expectations in organization, but most of the time it means dodging one, which involves organized passivity, willful ignorance, lowering expectations, and even undermining rank-and-file organization. The Polish revolutionary Marxist Rosa Luxemburg was one of the first to recognize the character of this new layer when union apparatuses became more established in Germany in the 1890s. She wrote at the time, "The naturally restricted horizon, which is bound up with disconnected economic struggles in a peaceful period, leads too easily to bureaucratism and a certain narrowness of outlook. Both, however, express themselves in the overvaluation of the organization, which from being a means has gradually changed to an end in itself, a precious thing to which the interests of the struggle should be subordinated. From this also comes that openly admitted need for peace and shrinks from the great risks and presumed dangers to the stability of trade unions and the overvaluation of the trade union method of struggle, its prospects and its successes. We have only to look at the massive bureaucracies of unions like the International Brotherhood of Teamsters or the Service Employees International Union to know that there is not much distance between the Germany of 1890 and the United States of 2018 in this regard. Luxembourg's recognition of the bureaucracy's narrowness of outlook is also hitting on another conservative influence on trade union officials, which is that they are compelled to represent the interests of a highly politically heterogeneous working class in a given workplace or sector of the economy. This approach creates a political framework that skews towards the lowest common denominator of working class consciousness in a given time and place. In addition, professional trade unionists, especially at the higher levels, are at least a significant step removed from the lives of the workers that they represent. They are not subject to the same oppression of ruthless supervisors, they usually make significantly more money, and are immune from layoffs and other threats to job security. Their degree of distance from rank and file life, their role negotiating the terms of exploitation, and their lack of actual control over economic conditions means that they take on the characteristics of the middle class under capitalism, which includes attempting to temper the central contradictions and vacillating in the greater class contest. Now, this is just a starting point. There is wide variation in the character of particular trade unions and within particular trade unions across time and space, but they all operate under this broader dynamic. There are officials with more left-wing or in more right-wing politics. There are smaller union locals who have a closer connection to rank and file interests and are more democratically controlled. And there are important differences between full-time elected officials who maintain rank and file jobs, senior staff, lower level staff, etc. But as Clifton Gluckstein write, of course the bureaucracy is not homogeneous. Union officials in different industries find themselves under varying pressures from below and above. Again, ideologically, union officials are not the same. The division between left and right union officials is significant. Splits in the bureaucracy between unions or within a union can weaken its conservative influence. The fundamental fact, however, overriding all differences between bureaucrats is that they belong to a conservative social stratum, which especially at times of radical crisis, makes differences between left and right bureaucrats secondary. At times, all sections of the bureaucracy seek to curb and control workers' militancy. As long as there have been unions for a definitive amount of time, they develop bureaucracies. And as long as there have been bureaucracies, socialists and revolutionaries have developed strategies to deal with them. There are at least four major trends in how the left has approached the question of union bureaucracy. And I'll try to touch on each in turn. And they are syndicalism, what I would call syndicalism, red unionism or dual unionism, permeationism, and the rank and file strategy. So syndicalism is an idea rooted in revolutionary working class anarchist tradition, and has had significant influence in the mostly in the turn of the 20th century in places like Russia, Spain, the United States, among other places. Here in the U.S., it was organizationally expressed by the incredibly important radical union movement called the International Workers of the World, the IWW, known as the Wobblies. Their approach to the conservatism of bureaucracy was simply not to have one. They organized massive, heroic strikes and trained some of the best working class radical organizers of the early 20th century. But they intentionally established no formal union structures or permanent contracts between employers and workers. This solved one problem, but created another. As soon as the level of militancy among rank and file activists died down and the IWW left town, the employers quickly regrouped and immediately clawed back most of the gains made during those struggles. Red unionism, or dual unionism, was another response to the political conservatism of union bureaucracies. This was a policy pushed by different revolutionary socialist and anarchist groups, most famously by the Communist International from 1920 to 1923, when it established the Red International of Labor Unions, and then later by the Stalinized Comintern in 1928 in the so-called Third Period, where all communist parties were directed to pursue a policy of dual unionism. Both syndicalism and dual unionism are two sides of the same coin. They involve abstention and avoidance of being immersed in the messy and challenging world of building consistent socialist rank and file organization within the broader union movement, usually developing its own top-down approach to politics and struggle in the workplace. And just real quick, red unionism is essentially setting up only revolutionary socialist unions or socialist unions as against the current formations of unions like the AFL-CIO or the union formations in Europe and whatnot. So then permeationism. Permeationism is a more straightforward idea that is the default practice of reformist socialists throughout the late 19th century up to the present day, but also was utilized by the Comintern between 1923 and 1928, and then imposed after the disastrous Third Period tactics of dual unionism by Stalin between 1933 and 35 with the introduction of the Popular Front strategy. Charlie Post is giving a talk on Sunday. Is Charlie here? On the Popular Front, and I'm sure you could give us some little tidbits in the discussion period. But suffice it to say that it was the policy implemented directly out of the needs of Stalin's foreign policy to build a cross-class alliance against Nazi Germany. In the case of the U.S., this meant emphasizing the primacy of building an alliance between the Communist Party, the Roosevelt administration, and the newly formed union movement called the Congress of Industrial Organizations, known as the CIO. Permeationism simply means having socialists insinuate themselves within the union bureaucracy in order to try and shape its politics and practice. This was the default strategy of the social democratic-led unions within the Second International, because there was no contradiction between their vision of reforming existing capitalism through parliamentary means and economic advancement within unions. The bureaucracies of unions were well suited to the vision of focusing uniformly on reforms and developing or grabbing hold of reformist organizations in order to do so. This strategy was coupled with binding unions to the process of parliamentary reform. In Europe, Latin America, and elsewhere, unions and labor-based reformist political parties went hand in hand. Prior to the Popular Front, this had an expression early on in the Socialist Party in the United States, who didn't have a trade union strategy per se, but did have trade unionists who did electoral work within the unions. In the mid-1930s, and also they had unionists who did amazing union work in the union movement. In the mid-1930s, as FDR began to implement the New Deal and the CIO was on the rise, the Communist Party oriented heavily on infiltrating the CIO's top leadership positions, achieving left-hand man status to the three leaders of the CIO, John Lewis, Sidney Hillman, and Philip Murray. CP members, or former members, were both the chief counsel and publicity director for the entire CIO Federation. It's a very high-level positions. More pervasively, they oriented on taking staff jobs in individual CIO unions, taking over the leaderships of staffs, leaderships and staffs of CIO locals, with the goal of helping to organize the upsurge in unionism and binding that to the left wing of the Democratic Party and the project of Roosevelt's New Deal and war effort. The CP still had thousands and thousands of rank and file militants who did amazing work in this period. But ultimately, that work was circumscribed by the larger goals of the Popular Front. And when World War II came along, subordinated that work to winning the war effort. The CP and CP union activists supported and enforced the No Strike Pledge during World War II, supported the state repression of Trotskyist union militants, abstained from important struggles for racial justice, and supported Japanese internment. And then they for their trouble of doing the bidding of Roosevelt and his ilk, after the war, they were purged out of the labor movement with the McCarthyite witch hunts as the U.S. ruling class shifted towards the Cold War. Len Decaux, the former CP member who was the publicity director of the CIO that I mentioned earlier, gave an ironically apt description of what the CIO would become in the post-war period in the wake of the defeat of the CP's permeationist strategy. And this is quoted from Kim Moody's essay, The Rank and File Strategy, which is in this collection from Haymarket Books. He said, "Once the CIO won all that capitalism would allow it, sit-downs and mass struggle gave way to union administration, dues collection, labor board briefs, detailed negotiations. The swivel chair tribe began its own long-standing sit-down and union office." "This tribe rode to office on the broad shoulders of Lewis and the backs of the agitators, the militants, the Reds. Once they arrived, they turned dutifully, patriotically, devoutly, to kick in the face those on whom and over whom they had scrambled." Permeationism continues to this day in the U.S. labor movement as the de facto strategy of groups who are remnants of these previous tendencies. The modern U.S. labor bureaucracy is chock full of former and current Communist Party, Maoist, and Social Democratic organizations, all of which share a uniform strategy of top-down reform within unions. More militant business unionism, they share the uniform strategy of top-down reform within unions, more militant business unionism, and left realignment in the Democratic Party. The rank-and-file strategy, on the other hand, flows from a political strategy of revolutionary socialist transformation of society, a project long abandoned by the Communist Party and never adopted by social democracy. It is a strategy for how socialists orient within the labor movement and how they build socialist politics and organization within it. This should first be distinguished from a broader conception of a rank-and-file strategy to rebuild the labor movement. The two are related but nonetheless distinct. Within the labor left in the United States, as exemplified by conferences and projects such as Labor Notes, the Center for Workers' Democracy, and others, there is a projection of this idea that has relatively little to do with the building of socialist organization directly. Many non-socialist union militants have become clear that in order to change the labor movement, it must be done on the shop floor. This is the basis for this broader conception of the rank-and-file strategy to reform the union movement. The more specific conception of the rank-and-file strategy the more political and specific conception of the rank-and-file strategy is rooted in the Communist Party and the early 20s project called the Trade Union Education League, where former syndicalist William Z. Foster, along with an uptick in strikes in that time period, developed a strategy that allowed for revolutionary socialists to attempt to build a broad socialist current within the union movement using socialist politics, workplace struggle, and both rank and file and socialist organization. This strategic orientation was revived most famously by the Trotskyists in Minneapolis in the 1930s, who not only helped lead one of the three major strikes of 1934, but helped build socialist politics and organization while doing so, and then advanced the struggle throughout the entire trucking industry in the region. One of its leaders, Farrell Dobbs, wrote two important books on the period, one of which is perhaps the best place to start, which is Teamster Rebellion, and then followed up by the book Teamster Power, which really provides an invaluable case study in the successful implementation of a socialist rank and file strategy. The socialist rank and file strategy carried through on a much smaller scale throughout the 50s and 60s, mainly through the individual socialist militants and smaller Trotskyist groups like the Workers' Party and others, which was the loose predecessor of the later group, the International Socialists. One of that period's most prominent and successful revolutionary socialist organizers, Stan Weir, has a great book of essays called Single Jack Solidarity that details the struggles of that period. Moving into the 70s, a major rank and file upsurge began to take shape in the United States as capital was beginning to restructure in what is now known ultimately as the neoliberal period. This was marked at the time by production speed-ups and increasing attacks on what remained of shop floor organization, combined with the near universal and resolute collaboration between the labor bureaucracies of all the major unions and big business. The International Socialists were at the center of relating to and helping to advance this rank and file rebellion, which is detailed well in books like Rebel Rank and File and a more specific study called Rank and File Rebellion, Teamsters for a Democratic Union. The rise and fall of these struggles, however, produced a tension in how socialists should relate to this upsurge. The International Socialists, drawing from the experience of the Trade Union Education League, the Minneapolis Teamsters, the Workers' Party, and the black-led revolutionary union movements of the late 1960s, of which the most famous book is called Detroit, I Do Mind Dying, which I highly recommend as well, initiated or were involved in a number of rank and file formations in the Teamsters, Steelworkers, Auto, and several other sectors. Postal. These formations differed in their character, but the IS in some cases attempted to develop and win a politically left and socialist orientation in many of these formations. A similar dynamic developed, or a similar dynamic and movement was already underway in the United Kingdom, where the British Socialist Workers' Party also succeeded in developing a socialist current within the emerging shop stewards movement. The SWP in Britain systematically recruited radicalizing workers and built factory branches that then helped to shape the broader shop steward movement. This was one significant part of their broader approach to building socialist organization in the UK. Facing a much greater challenge of the absolute segregation of socialists in the US labor movement, brought on by McCarthyism and the failures of previous left strategies, the IS, by and large, chose a strategy of industrialization, which meant that the vast majority of their activist work by the early to mid-1970s was within unions, which they accomplished by getting younger radicals hired within those industries in order to carry out this work. A debate then emerged within the IS about how open revolutionary socialists should be within this work and how exactly to introduce politics within workplace organizing. This, among other issues, led to a split in the IS, which in 1977 resulted in the founding of the International Socialist Organization, of which I am a member of here today. And this, which the ISO favored a more explicit and more open and aggressive approach to being socialist in the union movement. The remnants of the IS, along with the conception of a more industrialized version of the rank and file strategy, was reconstituted into a new group called Solidarity in the early 1980s, which then initiated the Labor Notes Project, named after the labor column in the IS's socialist newspaper, Workers' Power. When the rank and file movement was brought to an abrupt halt by the Volcker Shock in 1979, which signaled the onset of the employers' offensive that has lasted to this very day, it left radicals remaining in union work increasingly isolated and surrounded by a conservatizing working class in the Reagan era, and increased pressure to play down explicitly socialist politics. Moody argues in his important essay called The Rank and File Strategy that in the US in particular, class consciousness is far lower than in most other industrialized countries. And it is also a precondition for rebuilding a socialist current within unions. The group Solidarity developed what I would call a more stage-based approach of building rank and file union organization as a necessary precondition for the later project of building socialist organization. Although plenty in that grouping built socialist organization in a number of different ways, both inside and outside of the labor movement. The ISO attempted to develop a more consistently political approach that saw the need to do these things simultaneously, and that in the weakened state of the left in the 1980s, there was a premium placed on rebuilding revolutionary socialist cadre, the prospects for which were not primarily within the union movement at the time. Even so, the ISO carried out important union work as socialists, both within and outside of workplace organizing, helping to organize unions and build union struggles as socialist movements throughout the 80s up into the present period. These debates and divergent strategies continue today. The main difference being that they are on a much better footing as the U.S. has experienced the beginnings of the most widespread political radicalization since the 1960s. In fits and starts, this has found an expression in union work, with the Wisconsin Capitol occupation, the Chicago teacher strikes, and most recently, the Red State Teacher Rebellion this last spring. This new radicalization is more class conscious and socialist oriented, with the rise of groups like Democratic Socialists of America, which the remnants of Solidarity have mostly joined up with today. The ISO's work in teachers unions and healthcare unions and a number of important projects combined with the political and organizational developments of the labor left offer new opportunities for revolutionaries today to rebuild a socialist current within unions and the broader working class movement. We in the ISO think that the theory and practice of an explicitly socialist rank and file strategy is really the best way to make sure this happens.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.